Hi, good evening. Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms with myself, Neil Denny, and with Padre Greedy. Little Atoms is a live talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant and recurring theme, then it coalesces around the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean freedom of expression, free inquiry, empirical rationalism, scepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And I'm going to hand over to Padre to introduce our guest tonight, who is Kenan Malik.
Good evening. Kenan Malik is a writer, lecturer and broadcaster. He's the author of Strange Fruit, Why Both Sides Are Wrong in the Race Debate, and his new book, From Fatwa to Jihad, is published in the spring. Ken, let's talk first about the arguments in Strange Fruits. The concept of race itself is something that we talk about a lot, but we don't really engage with where it's from. What is it? Is it a scientific concept, a cultural concept? How would you define the idea?
It's a very new concept historically. There's a tendency to think of race as something that's always existed, that people have always seen other people in racial terms, and that's simply not the case. If you go back to Greek times, for instance, there were clearly divisions. They make divisions between people, but those divisions were not biological, were not in terms of biological inheritance. They were largely civilizational, you know, between us and the barbarians, as it were. If you go back to Christian Europe, medieval Europe, the distinction, again, was not biological. It was based on law and faith. Mm-hmm. And that distinctions between different groups were based on their relationship to law and their relationship to faith. And it's not till the 18th, 19th centuries that the idea of biological differences and the idea that you can divide people according to biological descent, and that's a useful and important way of dividing up the world. It's not until then that becomes an important aspect of Western thought. And it's not really till the end of the 19th century that it becomes a dominant view in Western thought. So it's actually a very, very new idea.
Mm-hmm. But it comes, I mean, you're talking late 18th, early 19th century, we were talking really about race being a product of Enlightenment thinking. Is that the case?
Well, that's yeah. I mean, there are kind of two views, traditional views in race. One is this idea that it's always existed. The other is the idea that it's a product of the Enlightenment, the way that, for two reasons, it's usually seen as a product of the Enlightenment. Firstly, because it was the Enlightenment that helped categorise the world, put the world into different boxes, mm-hmm. You know, the rise of scientific rationalism and so on. And secondly, of course, it was in the post-Enlightenment world that you had the colonial imperial takeover of the rest of the world, the Western expansion. And those two things come together. And also the idea that's very dominant in the Enlightenment about universal notions, universal laws, the idea that there's one set of one way of looking at the world that is useful, the idea of the truth as opposed to many truths and so on. And so the Enlightenment has now become seen as a source of the idea of race, and it isn't. We need to kind of untangle a few things. The source of the idea of race, in a sense, is the counter-Enlightenment, the arguments against the Enlightenment, the romantic reaction to the Enlightenment. The reason why the Enlightenment is important in the idea, in the notion of race, is that it made the ideas of equality and universality central to Western thinking in a way it hadn't been before. These ideas would already been there. I mean, within Christian thought, for instance, it's a very important component of Christian thought. But the idea of equality within Christian thought is very circumscribed. I mean, if you're not Christian, you don't have much chance of equality. And so equality and universality is a very circumscribed notion. And it really flowers in the Enlightenment, and in particular within what Jonathan Israel calls the Radical Enlightenment. He divides the Enlightenment, and I have a lot of sympathy with him, into the mainstream and the radicals. The mainstream are the Enlightenment thinkers. We usually talk about people like Kant and Locke and Hume and so on. The Radical Enlightenment are those who are, in many ways, on the periphery. Mm-hmm. People like Spinoza, Diderot, Condorcet. But even though they were on the periphery, it's their ideas, in a sense, that are much more important in creating modern progressive thought, because it was the radical Enlightenment that pushed the notion of equality, of universality, of secularism, that was consistently anti-religious, anti-clerical in the way that the mainstream wasn't. And so it's out of the radical Enlightenment that these notions arise. But there's a problem arises as well, which is this, that for radical Enlightenment thinkers, progress, social progress, would overcome inequality. That kind of almost religious belief in the idea that social progress would overcome economic and social inequalities. But in practice, that didn't happen. In practice, inequalities seemed more entrenched and deeper by the end of the 18th century, by the 19th century, than it had been prior to that. You know, the rise of capitalism, the creation of a more global world system, all of these showed up inequalities in a much sharper way. So there seemed this contradiction between an abstract belief in equality, which was deeply, deeply set within the Enlightenment, and the practical reality of an increasingly unequal world. And that progress, far from creating greater equality, actually seemed to create greater inequality. And race comes out of that contradiction, because it becomes a means of explaining that contradiction. Because people start asking themselves, why is it if we all believe in equality, if we have progress, why is it that certain people don't seem to be equal? Why is it that certain people, certain groups, don't seem to be able to progress? And so the idea grew that the reason was that certain people are by nature incapable of progress. They're incapable of taking advantage of the fruits of civilization, as it were. So it is in that sense, in the sense of that contradiction between the enlightened, abstract Enlightenment belief in equality and the reality of a society which was becoming more unequal, mm-hmm. that the idea of race emerges in the 18th century. But in the 18th century, people don't really think about it that way. There's a famous quote from Hume, who talks about blacks as being naturally unequal, and naturally inferior. And people always use this to say this is what Enlightenment thinkers thought. In fact, that comes in a footnote to one of his essays, and you know, I think it's quite telling that it comes only in a footnote, and that's the only thing people can drag up, because in the main, the arguments were different. And nevertheless, those ideas were beginning to gain ground. And you know, people like not just Hume, Voltaire believed in these kinds of arguments, because they were trying to Kant too, because they were trying to make sense of a world. And make sense of that contradiction. It wasn't until the 19th century, however, that it then becomes a dominant way, and particularly the second part of the 19th century, it becomes a dominant way of thinking about the world. Mm-hmm. And that the kind of the more universalist, humanist notions of the Enlightenment then become, not crushed, but sidelined, mm-hmm. As the idea of race then becomes the principal way of making sense of the world.
So at that point, then, we're at the late 19th century, and the obvious idea to raise is Darwinism. So let's perhaps look at how those ideas are then incorporated into the idea of race.
Well, in a sense, Darwin changed everything and nothing. He changed everything because, obviously, the idea of evolution, about natural selection, has had a profound impact both in science and in the way we understand society. But he changed nothing because, in a sense, the ideas of, for example, the notion of the survival of the fittest, which is often attributed to Darwin, didn't come from Darwin at all. It came from Spencer, who wrote it, I think, some 10 years before The Origin of Species. So, in a sense, Darwinism never was not necessary for racial science. Racial science already was already there. Darwinism provided a means to give it some kind of scientific credibility, even though the Darwinian ideas within racial science was the very opposite of what Darwin would have seen as Darwinian notions.
Perhaps we could go back as well to talk about, you mentioned the idea of the counter-enlightenment, and you know, as I was saying in the introduction, this show is very much predicated on the ideas of the Enlightenment, and perhaps we should have a bit of a discussion about what the counter-enlightenment actually is.
Yeah, well, the counter-enlightenment is... as you know, there's a big debate about, is there a single enlightenment? Are there many enlightenments? Can we talk about the enlightenment? There's even even greater debate about, is there a counter-enlightenment? Are there many counter-enlightenments? And there clearly are, in the sense that there are many traditions, there are many movements that were opposed to enlightenment ideas, enlightenment beliefs. Partly it came out of clerical reaction. Partly it came out of the experience of the French Revolution. And the fear that the French Revolution caused throughout much of the rest of Europe, in Britain, for instance. I mean, it's interesting, for instance, that if you look at the anti-slavery movement, which was quite strong at the end of the 18th century, post the French Revolution, suffered a dip. And it wasn't until afterwards, after the Napoleonic Wars, that it started gaining support and credibility again. So the counter-enlightenment... Are kind of series of disparate views, but coalesce around the idea that the notion that there is no such single thing as the truth, that reason is not the most useful way of understanding the world. That I think it was Edmund Burke who said, rather than give the masses reason which they don't fully understand, why not give them wholesome prejudices which can train them far better? The idea that rather than democracy. The king and the church, the monarchy and the church, would be better suited to organising society. But it's slightly complicated because there are strands in, say, the romantic reaction to the Enlightenment, which are actually quite progressive. Mm-hmm. The romantic reaction to the Enlightenment, in many ways, has shaped modern progressive thought as well as modern conservative thought. But at the heart of that, for example, it shaped much of... a lot of anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist thinking too. But one of the arguments that came out of that romantic reaction was the idea that there is no such thing as a single civilization. There are many cultures, that every people had their own culture, had their own ways of thinking about the world, their own beliefs, their own values, their own lifestyles, each of which was as valid and as truthful in its own context as any other. And that, interestingly, that romantic idea of many cultures, the plurality of cultures, fed into both the ideas of race in the 19th century and in the 20th century into the ideas of multiculturalism, pluralism, which is seen as the opposite of the ideas of race. In other words, both racial thinking and what we now call multicultural thinking both have their roots in the romantic reaction to the Enlightenment.
I mean, you've made a very good documentary in the past about multiculturalism, and I think that there's all this slight confusion, certainly in my mind, that there have been general conversation about the difference between multiculturalism as a fact, just the fact that a lot of people from different places live in one place now, so in any major city, and multiculturalism as a political idea. And often when one is seen as criticising multiculturalism, you're seen as criticising the fact rather than the political idea.
Yeah, I think it's a very important distinction to make. And the way I see it is that there's a distinction between diversity as lived experience and multiculturalism as a political process. I mean, diversity as lived experience, we're talking about, for example, in Britain, the impact of mass immigration in transforming Britain over the past half century, making it less inward-looking, more vibrant, more cosmopolitan, making it a much better place to live in than it was half a century ago. That's diversity as lived experience. But multiculturalism as a political process has come to mean something else. It is this idea that we all live in our little ethnic identity boxes. That if you are Asian, there are certain ways of behaving Asian. If you're black, there are certain ways of behaving black. And that public resources should be allocated according to one's ethnicity, background, race, identity, and so on, rather than according to need. And the consequence of that has been to institutionalise difference in the public sphere. And in many ways, multiculturalism as a political process undermines much of what is valuable about diversity as lived experience. Because, you know, why is diversity good? Well, diversity isn't good in and of itself. Diversity is simply a fact about the world. But what's interesting, what's useful about diversity is that it allows us to expand our horizons, to think about other people's other ways of doing things, other cultures, other lifestyles, other beliefs, and ask, you know, is that better than mine? Is mine better than theirs? To have that kind of dialogue and debate through which you can create a more universal, paradoxically, a more universal language of citizenship. But multiculturalism as a political process undermines our ability to have that dialogue and debate, precisely by putting people in their different boxes, and by, in the name of tolerance and respect, shutting down our capacity to make judgments. You can't say that. It's offensive. Mm-hmm. So in the name of tolerance and respect, shutting down the kinds of open dialogue debate necessary to make the most of a diverse plural society.
That's, I mean, it seems like as far from a progressive idea as you could get, the idea that there are these sort of ossified cultural norms that people, all people, and forget individuals, or, you know, all people that happen to have been denoted as part of that culture will inevitably adhere to, and as you said, the idea that you can, you know, almost take a sort of a grab bag of experience from a range of different cultures, which is obviously most people's everyday experience. It doesn't seem,
of course,
part of that.
I mean, multiculturalists will say this is not what we're saying. They insist that we're not saying that, you know, all Muslims are the same, or all Asians are the same, but we're not putting people into boxes. And in theory, they're not, but in practice, that is how multiculturalism expresses itself, and there is no other way it could express itself. If you believe that, for instance, the public policy and public resources should be allocated according to ethnicity, then it is inevitable that you will put people into those ethnic boxes, and you will fund things according, not people's needs, but according to which box they fit in. And that's a problem. However multiculturalists may think about this, in practice, it can only end up in that fashion.
I'm blatant plug, but Kenan has written in the current issue of Index on Censorship, on the Rushdie affair, and of course he's got a book coming out next year. And in some ways, Kenan, you would describe that as a watershed moment in multiculturalism and a failure of the left to engage properly with culture and the exact idea of Muslims are offended by this.
Yes, I mean, in retrospect, you can see how important the Rushdie affair was. One of the points I often make is that if you compare the response to the Rushdie affair, to the Satanic Verses, to the response to a novel that was published this year called The Jewel of Medina, which was a novel published by an American journalist called Sherry Jones, which is a story. It's a kind of Milton Boonish kind of romance about Aisha, who was Muhammad's youngest wife, a child bride. And Random House in America bought the book for $100,000. And they sent out the book to various academics hoping to get endorsements, and one of them wrote back saying this is offensive to Muslims. And Random House immediately pulled the book because they didn't want to offend Muslims. And if you compare that to the Satanic Verses, where despite the fatwa, despite the fact that Penguin employees had to wear bulletproof vests, you know, had X-ray machines in their offices to sniff out explosive packages, had armed guards outside and so on, despite all that, nevertheless, Penguin still continued publishing the Satanic Verses. So it gives a sense in which how much has changed, that a fatwa, a death sentence, couldn't stop the publication of Satanic Verses 20 years ago. Now all it takes is it's an email from an outraged American academic and publishers go running.
But I mean, there was an interesting thing I found about the Jewel of Medina case is that, maybe I'm being over-optimistic, but the response of the left now, the progressive end of politics, has been a lot better than it was 20 years ago.
I'm not sure it has. I mean, in the Jewel of Medina, it would be very hard to say we should not publish this. I mean, lots of people did, but you know, in the main, people said, "Look, this is just a romance. Nothing offensive in the slightest about it." You know? And most Muslims didn't care either. As I said, it wasn't Muslims who complained. It was an American academic, non-Muslim American academic who complained about it. But in general, I think that the idea that one must not give offence has become a central theme of our society. You know, we kind of tiptoe around peoples and cultures to make sure that we don't give offence. You know, you've had case after case. I mean, Beshti, the play in Birmingham, the Sikh play, which was pulled after protests.
After violent protests, should be pointed out.
That's true, but you know, it wasn't nearly as violent as a protest against the Satanic Verses. It should also be pointed out. You've had things like Idomeneia, the Mozart opera, which was pulled by the Berlin Opera House because they feared, nobody objected to it, but they feared that having because they had Muhammad's head on a stake. As in the opera, that would be offensive. We've had the Whitechapel Gallery in East London pulling a show of it had new dolls in it, but pulling a show not because anybody objected, because they feared that it might be offensive to local Muslims. You know, you've had case after case after case, and it's not just there are lots of cases with Islam, but there are lots of other cases. A couple of weeks ago, a poet whose name I can't remember was going to give a reading in Cardiff.
Waterstones pulled
it. That's right. Waterstones pulled it because his poetry was seen as blasphemous to Christians. So we live in a society where we are absolutely terrified of giving offence.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting example that you raised there, because that's an example of a group that fundamentalist Christians who have always been fair game for, you know, the liberal media to have a go at when they're uncomfortable having a go at other groups, and they've now seemingly learnt this lesson that they can raise this idea of complaint. And there was also at the same time the same group, Christian Voices, we're talking about this. Yeah. Let's not hesitate to name them. There was an exhibition at the Baltic Gallery in Gateshead where there was a Jesus with an erection or something. And they basically said, you can put this on, but we can't be held responsible for anybody going and vandalising it. You know, this sort of implicit threat. And what I'm struggling to get to here is also this idea that we're talking about the concept of, like, culture, people put into groups of cultures as being the sort of primary signifier of a person's being. And of course, this argument itself has been said many times, but I don't think it gets any worse for repeating. The BNP, for instance, have now cottoned on to this idea that, you know, that's a good excuse to use. So clearly, if there are all of these other groups of cultures, then inevitably there must be, you know, a white culture.
I think it's the biggest indictment of multiculturalism is that it's turned racism into a cultural identity. You know, because you're absolutely right. But the BNP taught the language of diversity, and they defend racism on the grounds that it is defending white history, white heritage, white culture.
It actually is White History Month at the moment, isn't it? According to the BNP.
Well, precisely. That's right. But the other side of it is this notion. I mean, this notion that Muslims take offence. Well, actually, if you go, you know, take the Satanic Verses, the vast majority of Muslims did not care a bit. It's interesting that prior to the fatwa, various Islamist groups in India, in Pakistan, and in Britain tried to create a big rumpus about it. Saudi Arabia came in, funded. A lot of the campaign. And Saudi Arabia and the UK, it was a set up an organisation called the UK Action Committee on Islamic Affairs, which tried to get the Satanic Verses banned in Muslim countries worldwide. Almost none banned it. The only countries that banned the Satanic Verses prior to the fatwa were those with large Indian subcontinental populations, places like South Africa, Malaysia, largely because of internal politics, because the campaign against the Satanic Verses began in India as part of kind of internal politics, and it spread to other populations, subcontinental populations across the world. Turkey, most of the Middle East, the Muslim communities in France and Germany, none of them cared a bit about the Satanic Verses. No, there was not a campaign against until after the fatwa. Mm-hmm. So this idea that Muslims as a whole, you know, somehow took offence is absolute nonsense. Similarly with the Danish cartoons. Again, there's this perception that Muslims as a whole hated the Danish cartoons. There were campaigns in Denmark by Muslims against the anti-cartoon campaigns. Nobody hears about them because we are so given to the idea that Muslims take offence, are offended by this. But in this case, the pictorial representation of the Prophet. I mean, there are major Islamic traditions which show the pictorial representation of Muhammad. So it kind of cuts both ways. And once Western society as a society decides that we can't do this because it is offensive to Muslims, all Muslims think that, of course, then Muslims will use that.
Yeah.
Because it comes to their advantage, because it is politically useful for them to use that to gain political leverage. That's exactly what's happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We could have talked for another half an hour, I'm sure, but thank you very much, Ken and Malik.
Thank you. Oh.